Our guest has a very special connection with Nepal, specifically the Khumbu region, which acts as the gateway to Mount Everest. Peter Lawrenson is a keen tramper, climber and photographer, and his love of the area was cemented on his first journey there in 1988. He's returned six times since, having forged a decades-long friendship with tea house owners, Pasang Di and Nima Sherpa. It was at their urging that he brought his eldest son, Ben, to Khumbu when he was 15, a journey which became a family rite of passage for his other two sons, Ed and Will, when they attained the same age. Peter's documented his three journeys with his sons, as well as the history of the region and his stunning photography, in a new book, Khumbu, Gateway to Mount Everest, Pathways to Kinship. I asked Peter to just give us really an idea of Khumbu and where it is.
Well, if you can picture Nepal being a kind of an oblong shape running horizontally between India and Tibet, with Bangladesh on the eastern side and Pakistan on the western side, then that's where Nepal is located, and Khumbu, which is on the northern border of Nepal, about a third of the way along its length, sitting on the Himalaya main divide with Mount Everest as being one of the highest point on that border. And that's where Khumbu is, and that's where the Sherpa people live.
Most of Khumbu rises well above sea level. Obviously, Mount Everest is the star, but it's at high elevation.
Yeah, the normal way to get into Khumbu is to fly into Lukla at 2,800 metres, and then you go along the Dud Khosi River Valley, and then quickly do a monster hill up to Namche Bazaar. That's at 3,500 metres, and then from then on, you're trekking mostly above 4,000 and well into 5,000 on quite a bit of it.
There are about five major valley and river systems, I think.
Yep, that's right, five.
You first went there in 1988, and what was that first journey like? You've described in the book how you were there almost by accident, after political unrest had closed some trekking trails.
Yeah, that was over in West Bengal. I was inspired to go up to Darjeeling by my grandfather, who's still with us, actually. He turns 103 in January this coming year.
Says a lot about the fresh air and good physical exercise.
Yeah. And he had suggested we had a look up in Darjeeling. I was on my OE in 1988, the big backpacker trip, and we got up in there, and there was political unrest that shut down the trails there. So at the last minute, we went across to Nepal and got there just before the monsoon.
Just before the monsoon. What happened when it arrived?
Well, we were getting a lot of cloud in the afternoons. Generally, the mornings were clear, so you know, you still got some beautiful views. But as we were there about 2 weeks, and by the end of those 2 weeks, the rain was really starting to come.
What was your experience then? Because I think you call this route the ants route now, because there's just that many people on it.
Yep, that's exactly right. That's the traditional route. You go up from Lukla and up through Namche and past Dingbashe, Periche, onto Lobaje, and then to Gorak Shep, which takes you then on to Everest Base Camp. And that's what the vast majority of trekkers follow when they're up in Khumbu.
So what's happened to numbers even in the time since you first went?
Yeah, okay. The accurate numbers are in my book. Whether they're in my head, that's a good test. But approximately, I think when I was first there in 88, there was something like 10,000 trekkers into Khumbu. By the time COVID had come along, that number had escalated to something like 60,000.
So it was. I think the tourism to Nepal itself is something like quadrupled here over the 3 decades you've been going there.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's become an important part of its economy.
Very important, yeah.
By the same token, we know the impacts it's having, and we'll talk more about that in a moment. Let's talk about Lukla Airport, because it looks, you know, to the outsider, it looks slightly intimidating. It's certainly been the way a lot of development's been able to happen in the region.
Yeah, it was a game changer. It was the Himalayan Trust was behind it, and Ed Hillary, he supervised the building of Lukla Airstrip. That was 1964. I came through in 88, and it was still then a dirt strip. It's the most level area in a vertical land, and it's also sheltered from big crosswinds, and that's the reason they chose to build it there. But it's still a really spectacular spot, because you approach it through the Dud Khosi Valley, so there's a 200 metre drop at the bottom end. The airport slopes, and it goes up to basically a mountain wall at the other end. And so planes come in and they use the gradient to slow down very quickly, and they also use it as a kind of an accelerant when they take off. It's pretty spectacular, even now that it's tar sealed.
Of the whole region, it was only open to Westerners in 1949. So, you know, you were coming in at a time where a lot of that opening up had happened, but the history and the people, the impact of that on the culture and the people that you met is what?
Well, it's been a long journey for me. I first went there in 88 as a naive backpacker, having not really learnt a lot about Khumbu or Nepal even before I arrived. It was really just exploring new places. But now it's 32 years later, and I've spent a lot of time thinking and talking and walking those trails and learned quite a bit. And so my book is all about, well, no, it's not all about, but a strong strand through the story is what has happened, what is the change. And if you look at it in terms of a cultural impact, development has been a wonderful thing for Sherpa. In terms of the Himalayan Trust, they bought schools and hospitals and infrastructure, bridges, and they've also opened up the region to economic opportunity. So all of that's been good for Sherpa. They had terribly high child mortality rates before all this happened. Opportunities were limited. You know, trading and farming was essentially what they did. Now the world has opened up. So that's on the plus side of the ledger. On the downside, for me personally, what I've seen since I started there, in 1988, there was an absolutely captivating feeling about meeting Sherpa people on the trail. They were all walking with their prayer wheels going on, Mani Padme Hum, you know, doing this thing that they believe so devoutly in. And Namaste, the divinity in me bows to the divinity in you. That was their greeting. And it was genuine, always genuine. So fast forward 30 years later, quite a few Sherpa in their modern gear, with their sunglasses and their headphones on, listening to their music. No prayer wheels, no namastes. It's just been dumbed down by mass tourism. I don't mean to criticise them for the way they are. They're just products of their environment, and that has been shaped by just the sheer volume of people that come through there.
In a very short time, and it's, you know, any number of cultures, it's the same story. But it's happened in a very short time, and this is what is unique about a place that was so shut off to Western influences, and then of course has had such an explosion of them. I mean, does Sherpa themselves have a view that they've shared with you about this change?
Yeah, absolutely. Particularly as I became more conscious about putting the book together, I was, you know, going in there and actually asking lots of questions, and so I've had some really good conversations. I met one guy. I'm just trying to think his name. I met him, but not just the ones up in Kundi, but he was 31 years old. So it occurred to me that he'd been alive basically for the time I've been visiting Khumbu, and I had a good chat with him. He's also a photographer, so you know, we clicked on that level. And he talked to me about how Khumbu had benefited hugely from the economic opportunity and the education and what have you that I was talking about earlier. But he also, in a very familiar way, said, yeah, but now the kids can't stay off their devices. They're gravitating further away from their historic culture. So things are changing. And the other thing was the environment.
Some of the things that struck you when you first went there, tell us about the Gompa or monastery you visited in Pangbosh, is it, with its unique claim to fame?
Oh yes, Pangboshe.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's not the biggest Gompa in the area. Tangboshe claims that fame, but what it did have back in 1988 were some relics of the Yeti. And so we went into the Gompa, and a little monk, a real character actually, he was kind of tolerating the intrusion of the Westerners, but in a very, very nice way. And we asked him about the Yeti, and so he just quietly went over to this corner, wheeled out this little box with a red felt on it, and then proceeded to show us this grizzled hand and this kind of scalp bowl-like thing. And he just looked at us and, you know, said, he didn't even say it. Here you go, seeing is believing.
Sir Ed himself had gone on an expedition, hadn't he, and was unable to find conclusive, unable to find proof, and I think concluded actually it was improbable the existence of this creature. But as far as the people are concerned?
Well, I think some genuinely believe, others take it as part of their myth and their culture. But it's still a colourful aspect to the story of Sherpa.
You forged friendships, and quite early on, I think, help me again with the pronunciation, Pasang Dorje Sherpa?
Yes.
And his wife Nima?
Yep.
You met them on your second trip to Khumbu, and this was when your son Ben was a toddler. How did that relationship begin, and how has it been maintained over many years?
Yeah, well, it began, as I write in the book, Nima was busy preparing food for trekkers, including myself, but she also had her toddler, Furudiki, who was just playing up, you know. And I was looking at poor old Nima and thinking, oh yeah, I've been here before, I know what it's like to have toddlers chucking food all over the place and playing up. So I said, oh look, let me do that for you. And so I did, and Fura and I struck off straight away, and she was back munching away. And that started a connection, which then followed with Pasang Dorje suggesting that he guide me to Chola, which was an area that I was thinking about going to. Actually, as it turned out, I didn't get up there that time because of a bout of Khumbu cough, which is my nemesis when I go there.
Yeah, what is Khumbu cough?
Oh, it's just the combination of factors that come together in the perfect storm. High altitude, thin oxygen air, cold, dry, and then also there's quite a bit of illness up there. So, you know, viruses and that sort of thing.
Dry cough that you tend to get when you're there?
Oh, it's vicious. You know, people have known to crack their ribs from it.
Oh.
I've had it so that it just drives me nuts, and it's debilitating as well. So, yeah, and it's common. A lot of people get it.
All right. Do you still keep in contact with them? Well, COVID obviously put a break to getting Kathy over to meet them too. But do you still keep in contact with them after all these decades?
Absolutely. And in fact, I didn't really get to answer your question properly before about the relationship, because it started back in 1995. And back then I hadn't realised just how significant it would become. And I didn't really see it as being an ongoing relationship. But in 2006, I came back with a German mate, Helga, and we were going to be trekking. And I hadn't contacted Pasang Dorje, but I just literally walked into him in Jorsalay. And he looked at me and he says, ah, Peter, but no Ben. And it was incredible the way that he just suddenly remembered, or, you know, instantly remembered who I was. And that prompted the dialogue in my own head about, well, maybe I better get my kids here at some point. And that first happened in 2009 with Ben, then 2015 with Ed, and 2017 with Will.
Before that, 2006, the political situation had changed in Nepal, and New Zealanders were being advised not to travel there. You went there. What did you experience that year?
There was a lot of disruption. There were demonstrations going on down in Kathmandu. The Maoists had imposed blockades at different points on the routes into Kathmandu, so goods and services were curtailed and you know, shut down. People were suffering quite a bit in that sense. But in terms of being a tourist there, I never felt in personal threat. There was no real angst directed at us. And then when I got up into Khumbu, there were no Maoists, and we just went out and did our trek. So in that sense, it was fine.
The special relationship, as you said, taking your sons there, and, you know, the experiences of taking a 15-year-old in the first case with Ben, what were some of the challenges experienced?
Ben was not that fit at the time, we experienced a few challenges pretty much from the first day. He got nauseous on the way, and we actually stopped in Jorsalay at 2,800 metres, and I guess he might have been feeling the altitude a little bit at that stage, and, you know, he had a vomit and, you know, feeling a bit under the weather. You know, he had the odd encounter with altitude acclimatisation issues as he went up. But he never flinched, and he embraced the challenge. So that was really the only challenge, I would say, that we had going in there. The rest of it was just joy, absolute joy. You know, father and son engagements, discussions we had that we never would have had if we'd just been clacking around down here in Wellington. You know, it was just such an intensification of the time together.
So Ed turns 15 in December 2015, and of course this had become the accepted thing now, that each boy would go at the age of 15. 6-year gap, and sadly this was punctured by the loss of Pasang Dorje and Nima's son Lakpa.
Lakpa Temba, yeah.
That must have been a real moment in your relationship.
Yes, it definitely was. I mean, it makes me feel emotional just when I think of it. Because they had a double whammy. The earthquakes in 2015 had flattened their 130-year-old Tibetan-style building. And that amazingly, they'd replaced it by the time we got there. There was a new lodge up there then. And then we got a messenger message from Fura, who was by then in Australia studying as a nurse. And she told us that Lakpa Temba had just suddenly died. He'd suffered from epilepsy as a child, and he would have been 15 then as well when Ed came through. So we arrived there, and it was very sad.
What a beautiful boy. Lovely image of him in the book. Yeah. Our guest is Peter Lawrenson. We're discussing his book, Khumbu, Gateway to Mount Everest, Pathways to Kinship, about his 30-year relationship with the region. You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National, and the photography in the book is, I'm trying to think of a superlative for it, or a non-superlative for it. It's amazing. It captures the mountains, obviously, and the landscapes. It captures the quite remarkable animal life. I don't know what this bird is. What's this bird?
It's a Himalayan snowcock.
Well, there you go. And what do we have? This big beast here.
It's a yak.
It's a big yak.
Oh yeah, they're impressive animals.
They don't muck around, do they?
Yeah.
What has been the role of the photography in your enjoyment of this region? And again, going back, what were you using back in the day in 88? It was, you know, pre the old smartphone. What was the kit you were using?
Yeah, I never used a smartphone. Mm. But back then it was a Nikon F801S. Good camera, a 35mm SLR camera shooting slide film and prints. So that's
good old slides. Clickety-click,
yeah.
Clickety-click, yeah. And then over time, have you change kit at all? Because landscape on the scale is not easy to capture in a way that has the effect that you know, a professional photographer or a very experienced photographer will capture.
Well, digital is a massive game changer. A lot of the pictures that you see, that, you know, these images spanning two pages, they're not one image. They're actually stitched 2, 3, 5 images sometimes. And that's only been enabled really through digital photography, but also as digital has developed and you've got raw files, the work you can do post shooting to really do justice to those landscapes is enabled through that. Excuse me.
Also the lives of the people that you capture as well. It's interesting, a lot of cultures are sensitive around being photographed and when to be photographed. And what's happening here in this image?
That's just a novice nun doing some study in a gompa.
And did you build a lot of trust with people and gain access perhaps, including with a camera that others might not?
Yeah, certainly within the Sherpa family that I got to know and love. You know, we could get really candid, lovely shots with them in a way you can't get with strangers because there's an engagement there. But generally, Sherpa up in Khumbu are used to tourists carrying cameras. They know that tourism is an enabler for them. And as long as you're not just downright disrespectful and aggressive in your photography, they're generally pretty relaxed about it.
Now, we didn't get to the third son travelling. This was Will. What year was this?
First, he's had two cracks at it. 2017 was his first trip. And then we had another go in 2019, just before COVID.
What of the situation with climbing? Are you much of a climber? Because we'll come to the controversies around Everest in a moment and what has become, you know, almost a tourist or a climbing escalator up and down the mountain. But have you done much climbing yourself? Have you done Everest yourself?
Oh, no, I've definitely not done Everest. I've never attempted to climb Everest. And I don't aspire to be honest, either, given the way things have panned out. But yeah, I've done a bit of climbing. I've climbed some of the main peaks in New Zealand. Overseas, more trekking than climbing. When I was there in 2015 with Ed, I went with a guide, Kami Timber, to climb Island Peak, Imjitse. We didn't actually get to the top. Got to 6,100 metres, but got blown off, basically. There was icy wind. This was in December. So that's the highest I've got in Khumbu.
What is your view then, and what is the view of those you've become friends with about what has happened with the commercialisation, I guess, of climbing? And New Zealanders have played a significant role in this. On the one hand, it has given people an extraordinary opportunity to do something incredible in their lives. On the other, it seems to have got to the point now where we see those images of, like, speaking of ants, people like ants going up in what is often a narrow window. And there have been other issues and controversies as well. Where do you sit on it, and where do others you know sit on it?
Well, yeah, I'd rather speak for myself more than for others, because there is a wide range of views. My opinion is that a place like Mount Everest is at the extreme end of climbing, not necessarily because of the route, although, you know, the route's still quite challenging, particularly the Khumbu Icefall, but just being up so high, going up into the death zone above 8,000 metres, and then the weather that has a huge impact, it makes it a very dangerous place. And my feeling is that people that climb the mountain should earn their stripes before they go there, rather than just paying a lot of money to very, very skilled climbers with all the technology and sat phones and everything else, and all the massive amount of Sherpa support that's provided, and getting up there on a short circuit route. I think it would be much better if there was a little bit less immediate gratification and more respect given to climbing that mountain. And the problem is that, you know, regardless of what opinion someone has about why people are doing it, the sheer fact is that the numbers up there also make it incredibly dangerous, where you've got too many people going to one tiny wee little piece of real estate right at the top past the Hillary Step, you know, we've seen in recent times these queues where people are literally sitting at 8,800 metres waiting for people to either come up or come down. It's a very dangerous thing to do.
After all these years, what takes you back? Obviously the friendships, obviously you love the place, but what is it that still keeps you going back?
Well, it's evolved. It's kind of, it's permeated my being in a way. Initially, I just loved the place and wanted to explore more of it. More recently, it's become a thing for me, you know, the book. So getting to the end of the book is a kind of a bit of a full stop. I still want to get there with my partner, Kathy, because she's never met the family, and I know Nima's absolutely hanging out to meet Kathy. That'll be really, really awesome when we can do that. But I also feel tinges of guilt as well, because during my journey over the last 30 years, and particularly in the last decade, I've become much more conscious about global warming and the impacts of international travel on that, and the effects that can easily be seen up in Khumbu as well. So I know that if I go back again with Kathy, I'm being hypocritical in some ways. But I would like to get there just one more time.
And that is Peter Lawrenson on his book just published in the last few weeks, Khumbu, Gateway to Mount Everest, Pathways to Kinship.